Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 21st, 2005, and this session, Redemption and American Politics, Why Bush Won, by Dan McAdams, presented in the Creekside Room. Disc number MCD 2005-04. Let's listen in.
At this moment, welcome. Thank you for coming. This is the fourth in a series of classes that I'm doing here at Holden this summer. The name of the series is The Redemptive Self, Stories Americans Live By. And the topic for today is the theme of redemption and politics. And we will spend some time focusing on the recent presidential election and entertaining some perhaps less conventional hypotheses regarding why, in fact, George W. Bush won that election and John Kerry lost. So we do sort of move in an interesting, different direction than I typically talk about in my classes. I am a professor of psychology and human development and social policy at Northwestern University. We have seats up here if you'd like. I teach courses on adult development and aging, on personality psychology, and so forth. But I have a lot of interests in politics as well. I have a handout, and I think I may not quite have enough. I have 25 of them here, and I believe there's a few more than that here. But please do take one, or perhaps share with your neighbor if we run low on these. And there was somebody who wanted my, I don't see him here, somebody who wanted my handout on day one, so I'll look for him. Okay. Some of you are new. This is the first time you've come to one of these sessions with me. Others have been around for the long haul. Let me say a word or two by way of background and review to get everybody sort of in the same place here this morning regarding the topic of redemption. As a psychologist, I'm especially interested in how people make sense of their lives, how they make meaning. Beginning in late adolescence and our early adulthood years, many psychologists believe, we start to put our lives together. We start to put our lives together into some sort of pattern that provides us with some sense of who we are, where we're going in life, and so forth. Psychologists, some of them call this the issue of identity. And there are a number of us in the field who argue that in late adolescence and young adulthood, we address this issue of identity by creating a story for our lives, by beginning the work of constructing a life narrative. And so a big question for identity for people older than their teenage years, all the way up through old age, is, you know, what is your story? What kind of a narrative are you working on? By the time we hit our midlife years, we're pretty far along in putting together a life story. We've got a pretty good sense, typically, of who we are, where we've been, where we may be going in the future. There are many different kinds of life stories that people might construct. You might have a Cinderella story that defines who you are. Your story may be something like Oedipus, the king. Maybe it's a tragedy, maybe it's an adventure story, maybe it's a romance. There are lots of different ways to put our lives together. I'm interested in one particular sort of kind of narrative, a story that I call the redemptive self. And I'm interested in this particular story because of the people who tend to tell it. In my research, my students and I have been doing research on this for many years, we have found that especially caring and productive midlife adults, men and women in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, who score really high on measures of what we call generativity. Generativity being a concern for the well-being of the next generation. People who score high on measures like that, who are very caring and productive midlife adults, they tend to tell life stories that resemble each other a little bit. We see some common patterns, and those patterns distinguish the kinds of stories they tell from the stories told by the rest of us, the stories told by people who are perhaps less generative. And the key theme that distinguishes those two sets of stories, you might say, is this theme of redemption. redemption meaning in general here the deliverance from suffering to an enhanced status or state. There are other themes that go along with this story, and I'm going to review those in a moment here. But what we have talked about a little bit in the past few days is how this particular kind of story, this story that I call the redemptive self, it's a pretty good story to have. It's an interesting way to make sense of your life. It provides you, for one, with a lot of confidence that things are going to work out in the long term. And perhaps it sustains us to have a story like this, to have a story in which we go through a lot of suffering, but we come out of suffering better down the road. If we know that that's kind of how our life goes, it makes it easier for us. It sustains us in our efforts to care for the next generation, to be of service to others as parents, mentors, teachers, leaders, pastors, civic participants, and the many different kinds of roles that many midlife adults have. So let's look at this story for a moment, and then we'll move away from it as a psychological idea and consider it more as a cultural narrative, and that will get us into the issue of politics. On the second page of your handout, that is the first page that has any substance to it, the one that looks like this, and I apologize for not having enough handouts. Perhaps someone could share. I had 25, so it looks like we have a few over 30 folks here. And this is my last one in my hand here. Sorry. You'll see these. Oh, you got some extras?
Oh, okay.
The story that I'm talking about, that highly generative adults tell, sort of goes like this. And I should, by the way, say that, you know, everybody's life story is unique, you know, everybody's story is different, but you do start to see patterns after a while, and this is sort of like a general script that many highly generative adults' lives sort of connect to in our research. Okay, how does the story begin? The story typically begins with a blessing. I'm fortunate. I'm lucky in some way. Maybe mom liked me the best, right? Maybe I had this wonderful teacher. Yeah, everybody in the room here can think of some blessing or advantage that they had early in life. But highly generative adults, very caring and productive midlife adults, make a really big deal out of this in their life stories. Early on in their accounts of who they are, they will set aside examples of how they were fortunate, okay? At the same time, they are about four times more likely than less generative adults to zero in on events in their lives in which they witnessed the suffering of others. Bad things happen. And again, everybody in the room knows that. You don't have to read the book of Job to know that there's suffering out there in the world, right? Everybody suffers. Highly generative adults, when they remember their childhood, they'll single out events where they learned about suffering, where they were sort of bowled over, they were surprised, they were taken back by the fact that, you know, there's evil in the world, there are bad things in the world. Again, something we all know. But would you tell your story that way? Would you set it up that way? Highly generative adults often do. I'm blessed, early advantage, others suffer. There's this interesting kind of contrast. Or another way to say it, another way that I say it in my writing sometimes, is that I'm the hero, the protagonist of the story. You have a blessed protagonist, a gifted protagonist, an innocent and good protagonist who journeys forth in a dangerous world. And it's as if these stories tell us early on two things. I'm lucky, the world is scary. Okay? Now, as people talk about their life stories, they talk about adolescence and young adulthood, a common theme that runs through that part of the narrative for highly generative adults is this idea that early on, sometime in my teenage years typically, I got my values squared away. Usually, not always though, through some sort of religious tradition, often through a religious tradition, but sometimes in other ways as well. Highly generative adults, as they describe their journey through life, it's not so much, and this bothers me, a journey of seeking, of like, gosh, I just don't know. I'm struggling with the issues. I don't know what's right. I don't know what's wrong. You know, it's up for grabs for me. They're not that kind of existential questers like that in our research. They're more like, yeah, I know what's right. I've got a solid core of values that I believe in, and it may be different from yours, and that's okay. You know, I'm not going to foist it on you necessarily, although I might, but probably not, okay? But the highly generative adult, the protagonist in the story, is likely to suggest that there's a pretty solid foundation here of values and belief, or what I call moral steadfastness. And it's not that, you know, I'm stubborn or that I don't, you know, change at all. But there's clarity, there's moral clarity and steadfastness that the protagonist in this story exudes. There's plenty of redemption in this story. We've talked a lot about that, different ways in which American generative adults tell redemption narratives. Typically, something bad happens, something positive follows, or if not that, something bad happened, and now I look back on it, you know, I think something good came out of it. And again, this is not to say that highly generative adults, caring and productive American midlife adults, tell these sort of silly, oh, everybody lives happily ever after stories. They're not like that, okay? There's plenty of bad stuff that runs through these life stories. But there's often positive messages that come out of the bad. So redemption is essential. There's an interesting conflict that runs through the life stories of highly generative adults oftentimes. A conflict between power and love. I'll come talk a little bit about that one tomorrow, because it suggests that, you know, this story is not all sweetness and light. There's some edginess to it. There's some interesting sort of conflicts that run through the life stories of highly generative adults. After all, these caring and productive adults, they are not, you know, gentle, self-effacing, oh, little old me type people. These are individuals who are really having an impact on the world. They feel like that they're, you know, pretty strong. At the same time, they're caring and warm. That's how they see themselves. And so that can sometimes lead to sort of an interesting conflict in the story. I'm powerful. I want to generate something. And I want to be cared for and liked and nurtured. And, well, we all have that. But highly generative adults, they make a bigger deal out of it in the life story. Okay, finally, as you look to the future, life stories are not just about the past, they're about how you imagine the future, how you imagine your future. Well, highly generative adults, when they think of their future, these caring and productive midlife adults, as they tell their story, extending into the future, they will accentuate or emphasize themes of growth, improvement. Makes sense. That's what generativity is about, really. Caring for the next generation, making things better down the road. And their life stories sort of tell that. Okay, so that's kind of the outline of the story that I've been talking about the last few days. Now, this is, as I've talked about it so far, a psychological story. You know, it's a story about the self. But the themes that run through it are broader than that. And what I want to suggest today is that the redemptive self, the story I've been talking about, is really as much a cultural narrative as it is a personal. And that is to say that some people see their lives this way, but and also in culture, you know, there are other sorts of things we see this way as well. We may see institutions this way. We may see American society this way. We may use the metaphors and the images that run through the redemptive self in other kinds of discourse, like in political discourse. So let's get into a little bit of political discourse here and take a look, if we might, on the next page at certainly one of the most famous pieces of political rhetoric in American cultural history. And this is some passages from the Gettysburg Address. And so I'm talking about this particular part of the handout here. We've got a picture there of Abraham Lincoln. And y'all, many of you probably know this address by heart or remember it from school. And recall that these are words that Lincoln gave a few months after the Battle of Gettysburg, which was one of the bloodiest battles in the Civil War, the American Civil War, and a battle that in retrospect is seen as, if not a turning point, at least a tremendously significant battle. And Lincoln is coming back to Gettysburg months later and commemorating the site where so many men. So let's just look at the, I'm going to read the sections, and every time I get a redemptive self feeling, I'm going to stop. Okay, so I'm going to stop. 84 and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. Brought forth, right? Conceived, generated something. I've been talking about this concept of generativity, these very caring and productive midlife generative adults. What is generativity about? Well, it's about giving birth to things, making things, producing things. And Lincoln is using that kind of language right at the beginning of the text. Our fathers, that's a paternal, that's a generative figure. He's talking about fathers in a very positive way here. Brought forth, gave birth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Okay, so this is a new nation, a young new nation, and it's a nation that is, in a sense, focused unswervingly on a very simple proposition. This is not a nation that gets up in the middle of night, wrings its hand, and wonders, you know, what are we doing here? Okay? It's very straightforward. We're focused. We're dedicated to a simple proposition that all men are created equal. It reminds me a little bit of the moral steadfastness idea in the life stories of highly generative adults. Not that they're all going around saying that all men are created equal, but that highly generative adults have these life stories in which there are these simple truths that are very important and solid, key values that give them a grounding. And so, too, Lincoln is suggesting that the nation is grounded, right, in something that's very self-evident and simple and straightforward. Now, we are engaged in a great civil war. And he goes on and talks about the war. Okay, well, this is a text about suffering. This is a text about bad things happening. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as the final resting place for those who here gave their lives that the nation might live. Well, certainly in the overall narrative of any nation, right? Those who give their lives so that the nation might live are participating in the most dramatic way in the redemptive move for those particular people. I mean, redemption is about the deliverance from suffering to an enhanced status. Or put differently, bad things happen today so that good things can happen tomorrow. And so these men have not died in vain, Lincoln wants to tell us. And of course, you know, this is said over and over in every war, right? It's a horrible thing, but perhaps necessary. Some people will die so that the nation will live on and flourish. And on the first day of the class, on Monday, I read a text on the 9/11 tragedy written by William Langewisch, a journalist. And he had worked, if some of you were here, recalled 9 months with the firefighters and others who looked for survivors and cleared away the rubble at the World Trade Center disaster site, beginning the day after September 11th. And what Langewasher was struck by, okay, what he writes about so beautifully in this passage, is this kind of redemptive sense, this exuberant belief, almost childlike, he said, that all this bad stuff will eventually give way to good things. That, okay, it was a terrible tragedy. Almost 3,000 people died, right? But something positive will come out of this, Langewasher seemed to think. Not, well, actually, Langewasher didn't think that. But he felt that the workers felt that, and that they were confident that they would find survivors, and they would rebuild the towers or rebuild something sooner or later, and that the greatest city in the world, which had been laid low, would come back like a phoenix from the ashes. I mean, it's just classic redemptive narrative here. And he says, Langewasher, there's something distinctively American. A kind of can-do, sort of exuberant, we're going to be better in the long run kind of optimism. And it's, you know, in a way similar here to what we're talking about when we talk about some giving their lives so that in the long term things will be better. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us the living rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. Okay, Lincoln is using a rhetoric here of progress and advancement. Okay, things will get better over time. The life stories of highly generative adults have this kind of progress sense, you know. Things get better. We talked about it last time together. Different ways to narrate redemption. Rags to riches stories, Horatio Alger stories, are redemptive narratives. Ben Franklin wrote one of the first ones in American letters. Stories of emancipation, like the slave narratives from the 19th century, talked a little bit about those last time, are stories of redemption. But there the redemption is not from poverty to respectability. There the redemption is from slavery to liberation and freedom. A very powerful way to narrate redemption. There are many other ways. Redemption via recovery, for example. Redemption via development. That we here are highly resolved, that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. Now, you know, what kind of nation is this, right? It's a special nation, under God. It has the ultimate early advantage, right? It is the chosen nation, Lincoln is sort of saying. Now, he's not being crass about it, okay? He's not, you know, saying that this is God's country and only God's country, right? But he is sort of suggesting, nonetheless, that this is a special, that this nation enjoys a special advantage, if you will. It is the chosen, good, special protagonist in a dangerous world. After all, we are fighting a war right now. It stands out as a kind of beacon of hope and light, an idea that runs through American political discourse going way back, even to the Revolution. That this nation under God shall have a new birth. There's more of that generativity imagery of freedom. And that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from the earth. A lot of redemptive themes there, a lot of ideas that remind us of the redemptive self, the idea of this being a special nation, in the same way that the protagonist of the redemptive self is a special person who enjoys an early advantage in life. Is chosen, mom liked me the best, God picked my nation, right? Who journeys forth in a very dangerous world, suffering. Well, how could you not talk about suffering at Gettysburg, and Lincoln does it beautifully, and yet tries to make the suffering redemptive, suggesting in the long run that this will lead to progress for this nation that is focused unswervingly, almost simple-mindedly and childishly, some might say, on this proposition, but it's a deeply held proposition that we don't doubt, and that is that all people are created equal, right? And then we move forth in life, we advance, we develop, and the future, well, we hope for growth. Lots of different ways Lincoln could have talked about the battle. This, I think, part of the power, there's many reasons, but part of the power of the address is that it resonates with a kind of cultural storehouse of images and metaphors that Americans have loved for hundreds of years, regarding, among other things, the idea that we are the chosen people, that we live in a dangerous world, but we're okay, we're better, that bad things are going to happen to us, but we will come out better in the long run, suffering will be redeemed, we will advance and grow. All right, I'm talking too much. So let's shift it to you a little bit and think about how it is that we use ideas like this in political talk, okay? Candidates talk this way. When we discuss political issues, some of these themes come up. Themes of redemption, themes of the chosen people, America as a force for good in the world, to redeem the world, and so forth. Examples, reactions? What do you got? Yes?
Since we're talking about the catalog of sessions about Bush, if you want to ask, but debates in which kind of the assumption was, you know, America's kind of a downswing of the economy, and, you know, one of the questions was, who is going to pull us out? Who is going to, you know, bring about this bright future, and, you know, which of the candidates had a plan? That seems kind of like a redemption.
Sure, sure.
Who's going to redeem America and bring it back into the glory of, you know, growing economy?
Yeah, things are never quite right, especially for the challenger, right?
Who's going to bring the jobs back?
Yeah, so if you're challenging the incumbent, okay, things are going to hell in a handbasket. You need to sort of recoup a great past, perhaps, or move forward in some positive way. So which of the two candidates can sort of provide us with this program of advancement?
Have you done any kind of international, because as you've laid this out, at least the cultural kind of narrative for this, simply from the Canadian perspective, you say, well, that's not our story at all. I couldn't identify.
Totally.
And so I'm wondering if, in that sense, is this, if you will, again, kind of specifically the U.S. story, or is this a claim that this kind of story you'll find in Canada, Germany, Zimbabwe?
Well, I was doing research on this for many years under the assumption of the latter. And that is, in the 1990s and so forth, I developed these ideas on the redemption. I wasn't calling it the redemption itself. And it's about in the, it was in the year 2000. I was giving a talk in the Netherlands to a group. And I was describing this redemption story. I wasn't calling it that. I had a different name for it. But the same themes that I just played out. Forget the American stuff. I was talking about life stories of highly generative adults. And in fact, for some of you who were here a couple days ago, I used the example of Jerome Johnson, the African-American police chief. Some of you may remember that story. In any case, Johnson goes through a lot of suffering and comes out of the group. So I do the whole spiel, and at the end I get a question from a lady in the front row. She said, well, you know, Professor McGavin's very interesting, but you know, these life stories, they sound so American. And I'm thinking, because I hadn't thought of it. I'm thinking, well, this is sort of the general way that highly generative, caring, productive adults tell their lives, okay? And I said, well, what do you mean by that, you know? And she says, well, you know, it's so optimistic. It's got a kind of like naivete to it. And so I'm thinking, yeah, maybe, I don't know. And so I kind of like mumbled my way through that question, and somebody else saved me. I got somebody else. But since then, I really turned me around. And so I think where I'm coming to on it is some of the themes are universal. But the way it's packaged, the way I've packaged it here, I think it is sort of characteristically American. And so when you say that, you know, it's not my story in Canada, I want to hear that. Because I'm hoping that I'm kind of playing out certain cultural things. They're not unique to the U.S. necessarily, but they are sort of a collection of themes that really percolate here in ways that they don't percolate in other societies. And so highly generative French women and men, and there are generative world over, right? What are their stories about? I don't think they look like this. But in any case, getting back to the politics part, you're not supposed to ask. You taught us in the joke class that I can ask the questions, but no.
I repent.
That's okay. That's okay. People talk about the Vietnam War as, you know, this great loss of innocence in the U.S. Of course, we've had these losses of innocence every 10 or 15 years.
Right.
John Kennedy was a great loss of innocence, but he was assassinated. It certainly was a turning point for many people's lives. I think there's some things about this story that are going to hang in there. You know, I could be wrong, but there's certain features of it that just seem to be kind of resistant, you know? They kind of morph and change over time, and the way we narrate redemption is different than we used to, but it's a good question. My guess is a lot of it will hang in there.
Look at World War I. I mean, you know, sort of the classic, the Great War, the loss of it. Yeah. So, you know, and yet the myth has, you know, has its word.
Yeah, I think that's right. So how do politicians and the rest of us talk about these themes in political discourse? Yes, sir?
I'll go back to a previous lecture in 1996, where Frederick Dole were running. Phraseology, Clinton was talking about building a bridge to the future, like looking very forward, and then Dole responded with building a bridge to the past. And, when
Oops.
He said that, I was like, oh, he's lost the election.
He's out.
because it doesn't follow that sort of forward progress idea.
Clinton's a master of the redemptive self, okay? I mean, that's one of many ways in which he would use redemptive rhetoric, and also his own life story, okay? Mm-hmm. Called The Comeback Kid, right? Lots of self-imposed sufferings, okay? He brings it on himself, but then he rises again. He
right, well, and did that sort of the initial giftedness is frequently called upon the boy, the man from Hope, the meeting of JFK.
You couldn't have done the movie better, right?
good example. Others, ways in which we talk about politics or power. Yes, back row.
The war in Iraq is, that's, it's a terrible thing, but it's worth it because something good is going to come out of it, and we change the news.
It keeps changing. You know, like originally it was going to be the weapons of mass destruction, and now we are
making the real story.
Yeah. So we're building democracy for the Iraqi people. We're building that nation. It's a kind of rhetoric that actually traditionally somewhat more liberal Democrats, I think, have warmed up to more so than sort of isolationist or conservative Republicans who typically say, let's not build nations, let's let them do their own thing. But in this case, that kind of rhetoric is something that the Bush administration has used to significant effect. Some other examples. Ways in which politicians talk about redemption, about these themes of the chosen people. Yeah.
I was going to say, wasn't it Al Gore in 2000 talked about an auto accident involving his son, or a son got hit by a car, and it was, he and his wife came together and moved beyond this and grew together as a result of this, as a result of this tragedy.
It's really an interesting thing that it's sort of an interesting kind of dilemma for a politician who's presenting a public story, and this does seem to be different than it used to be, and I'm not quite sure what to make of it, but I think it's really important these days for politicians to show the world that they're human, that they've gone through bad things, and that they come back from, okay? Now, we don't want our politicians to go through bad things and then get like beaten down by it. And so when Edwin Muskie, I don't know how many of you remember, sort of broke down in tears in the 68 or 72, I'm not sure, 72 election in a primary, he was a Democratic, one of the front runner from Maine. And people saw that as a sign of weakness. It turns out, by the way, at least according to Muskie, that he was crying because he was so angry about something that a local newspaper had written about his wife or something like that. I mean, and he just didn't like the coverage. But the picture of this man sitting, I think, on the back of a truck, sort of crying, I mean, it was not a good image. It was a little bit like Howard Dean's scream, right? One of those media kind of moments that turns against the candidate. Of course, there are media moments that often consolidate and work in favor of the candidate, okay? Maybe you think of those as well. Some other examples. Yes.
How about Dukakis and the tank?
Oh, man, yeah. Well, that's an example of a media moment that went awry, right? Okay. Yes?
Even though he doesn't talk much about it, look at John McCain, in prison 6 years in Vietnam, now he's a U.S. Senator. That's a story of redemption.
It's a very powerful story. Served as a POW for years, got through that. Really gritty story of American can-do optimism. It cuts across some political lines. I mean, there's a certain kind of heroism that he exhibits is admired on both sides of the political spectrum. The Democrats would love to get him on their side. And the Republicans like him too, although they're a little nervous about it because he doesn't always go along with the party line.
There are often ways also that the candidate can use a personal story or something that's happened in their family to cut through the partisan politics. I know that Gordon Smith in Oregon had a son with some mental health issues that committed suicide, and now there's tons of health issues going into the legislature based on that.
So
this story just goes a lot farther than anything that has to do with this Republican background.
Really interesting how people's life stories become resources for policy,
And passion, too.
And, yeah. So let's look at the last election, all right? 2004, Bush versus Gore. Now,
Bush, no, not Gore.
Kerry, yeah, John Kerry.
How quickly we forget.
There are many, I'm no expert, all right? There are many pundits and talking heads and people who really know about politics. Put forth a lot of theories regarding why Republicans of George W. Bush won that election, and many, many reasons. A reason that not too many people have talked about that I think holds a little bit of credibility, and the one I want to kind of play with today a bit, is the possibility that George W. Bush, in particular, and
the Republican faithful, more generally, have just been more successful in the past 10, 15 years, maybe even 20 years, in telling stories of redemption. Okay, they're just better storytellers. And I don't mean this in a pejorative way or in an admiring way. I'm trying to be neutral here. I mean, my politics are relevant, I guess, but I'm not coming at this from the standpoint of, you know, God, those Republicans are pulling the wool over our eyes because they're telling us these false stories, but nor am I coming at from the side that, you know, these are the true blue Americans who stick clear with our redemptive tradition. I'm trying to be objective and looking at it as an observer and asking, well, you know, it is interesting how certain kinds of themes get played out again and again in political discourse and how certain candidates are really better at dealing with these things than others. So let me make a couple of claims and then sort of open it up for your opinions here. I think that there's two ways to consider the relevance of the redemptive self, this story of redemption that I've been talking about, two ways to consider its relevance for the 04 election. The first concerns the sort of public biography of George W. Bush and the public biography of John Kerry, and the other candidate, the vice presidential candidates are somewhat relevant too, but less so. So that's one thing, sort of like, you know, how do we think about the candidates as people and their lives? And then the other part of it is, what do we see them representing? Okay, what kinds of policies are they pushing and so forth? And I really think on both of those levels that the Republicans, at least in the last election, outdid the Democrats with respect to redemptive narration. First, with respect to George W. Bush's life story, and especially as we might compare it to John Kerry's. I tell you that I find John Kerry an amazingly admirable man. I'm quite taken with him. I thought he was a great candidate. I thought he had a very compelling biography. The man who goes off to serve his country, as he did voluntarily, he's no draft dodger, right? He was out there, and he did see action. And he, swift boat veterans aside, he really did make some courageous, engage in some courageous actions. Wasn't out there for a real long time, but he served his country admirably, I believe, and I find it a compelling narrative. I find it compelling that he, before that, went off to college and did pretty well, although as we've learned recently, I guess his grades were not as high as George W.'s. Freshman year. Yeah, I'm surprised to see that. I don't know what happened back then. I find it admirable that he turned against the war on principle, and that he became a spokesperson once he came back as a veteran against the war, and I find his serving his country in the Senate admirable. So I think it's a great story, but it's a complicated story. It's a complicated story because you have to try to you have to kind of explain how he changed his mind, okay, and in the redemptive self, the protagonist doesn't really change his mind. The protagonist changes his heart, but he doesn't really change his mind. In the redemptive self, the protagonist knows what's right deep in his mind, well, his heart too, knows what's right. He doesn't always live it out, okay? So George W. Bush, all right, a man of strong moral vision and clarity, not a very complicated thinker, some have argued. His detractors suggest that, you know, he's not sophisticated, he's simple-minded, and so forth. But his admirers, and there are many out there, say, yeah, but he stands for something, like Reagan did, right? I mean, it's moral clarity, there's moral steadfastness there. That theme runs through the redemptive self. The protagonist is not somebody who's a flip-flopper, okay? That's not part of the redemptive self. It's the, you know, simple, guileless hero. On the next page of your handout, I've got a few notes on this. The simple, guileless hero. The innocent, good American hero who, yeah, gets into trouble, screws around, sows his wild oats, okay, but turns it around somewhere along the way. Many of George W. Bush's detractors point to the fact that he squandered a good deal of his young adulthood.
didn't do hardly anything productive for a long time. It was kind of a burnout, really. Daddy set him up with this, that, and the other thing. Nothing was all that successful until he kind of turned his life around somewhere in there after he met Laura and she had a positive impact on him. But eventually, he gave up drinking. Okay? It's a story of recovery and steadfast focus. Okay? And people like that. Okay? They find the simple, nihilist hero in a dangerous, unredeemed world. They see moral steadfastness. They see redemption via recovery. It's a simple story that many people can relate to and admire. So at that level, I think he's got it over Carrie a little bit. Not for me, maybe not, but for many people, the story is simpler and fits the themes of the redemptive self. So that's one possibility as a notion. Mike.
Well, I was just saying, I always think of the images of him working out on a ranch, you know, sort of, you know, sawing, you know, using the chainsaw to cut up the logs, driving around four-wheeler, you know, sort of, you know, working out there in the fields, getting his hands dirty, versus the images of John Carey on a sailboat out there in, right. I don't know, whatever it is, mm-hmm. Massachusetts, coastal mansion, or whatever it was. And so there's the idea of sort of the self-made in George Bush versus the
He apple. Looks self-made, even though he started life, you know, in a very, affluent manner. But there is in the story this sense of a man who's, you know, like the one people, the populist sort of image. It's part of the protagonist. The protagonist of a redemptive self is gifted on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, you want to have to, you know, sort of identify him as somebody who's, you know, really, really human. And Carey seems almost like superior in some way. At least some people argue.
You know, you talked yesterday about how it's hard for people who are affluent to really be able to identify with this. Redemptive story, and you know, I think on a subconscious level, maybe we realize that. And so that Bush's image of him working on the ranch seems to more clearly fit that picture versus John Kerry's image of, you know, his affluence.
Well, you need adversity in the story, right? You need some sort of an adversity. If you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth, or I think it was Ann Richards who, in a Democratic convention one time, said George Bush was born with a silver foot in his mouth. She was mad because he beat her back in the Texas gubernatorial race. If you can narrate adversity and how you sort of triumphed over it, that kind of fits the redemptive self pretty well. And you say, well, yeah, John Carey, he had adversity, right? And he triumphed over it, but it's not the same. And people look at that, you know, okay, he served his country, was the POW, but then he turned on it. Okay, he turned around. He said, yeah, but he did it on principle. Okay, yeah, but he changed his mind. Where's the moral steadfastness?
Maybe he changed his heart.
Well, maybe he changed his
heart. Or maybe he's willing to change with the times.
Which is not a theme that runs through the redemptive self. Highly generative adults, they're not rigid people. They are not rigid people. Most of you folks in the room, I bet, are highly generative adults. And a lot of us probably have stories that look a little bit like the redemptive self, okay? But probably the story suggests that there's a grounding in something, okay? And, you know, we can change with the times, we can be flexible, but within a certain kind of framework that we deeply believe in, that's probably how John Carey sees his life, I suspect. But it's hard to get the message across as a public narrative. Other thoughts on that? Yes?
I was going to say, in response to John Carey changed his heart about the war. If it's a changing of the heart, you said, you know, that the highly generative people in the story always know what's right. And so that makes it in the story that him going to war and being a soldier was wrong.
Right.
And that deep down inside he knew it was wrong to be a soldier. And that's not a story that the American people want to hear, that there's something morally corrupt about being a soldier. So that, I mean, you just can't fit that in as a positive
story.
It has to be his mind.
Yeah. For some other thoughts, thank you. Other thoughts on the biographies of the two candidates and how that relates to people's feelings about the election and so forth. Yeah.
Just pick up on that last little bit, because I think in Carey's case, to me, he didn't flip flop or change his mind. He was like a lot of young men. I was in Vietnam, and when the war started, you went to serve your country, or you were drafted. I'm sure the case in
awareness of. There's a lot of continuity there in terms of it's
but most people don't.
At least not enough to get
they think that that's a flip-flop.
Well, I was just going back to the point you were making. Carrie's story was more complicated. And, you know, in the sound bites that they're given to explain their story, it would be very difficult for him to get across this change of viewpoint. I think that's the difficulty. You don't get that. You just get this image of this guy that went through a redemptive experience.
It always amazed me because so many people went through that same story and know perfectly well how that was to initially support the war, you know, understand what was happening, and then, you know, be against it. And somehow that reality was never communicated. You know, and it was a real experience for so many Americans. I'm not quite sure how that got.
How did you feel about his efforts to, Jack Carey, that is, to sort of reinforce his image as a soldier in the whole, you know, like, you know. John Carey reporting for duty. I mean, some people, I think, thought, and I have to say at the time, I thought this makes sense. You know, he's got to win the people over who are, you know, sort of more hawkish maybe than I am. But a lot of people criticize him for that. They think in some way it sort of went against the kind of narrative he should be trying to portray.
That night, I thought it was great. When I saw him, I was really moved by it. But clearly, you know, the Bush campaign was able to turn that against him. And it wasn't his whole story. You know, that was part of his story, but the other part was coming to understand what Vietnam was about, and so it wasn't his whole story.
Let's consider redemptive rhetoric then from the standpoint of policy as well. Policy. And here what I would argue is that Republicans have been ingenious, going back to Ronald Reagan, in sort of, I don't know how they've done it, I don't want to say hijack, but they have taken this redemptive rhetoric that most all of us, liberal and conservative, you know, find compelling, and they've sort of claimed ownership of it, if you will. And maybe it's possible it didn't have to develop this way, but this is kind of how it seems to be today. I've got a few notes here on the Republican agenda and the redemptive self. These are just sort of general things, but there's 4 points here. First, there's a lot of talk in Republican circles, especially if you read columnists like David Brooks of the New York Times, who's a conservative columnist, but one that, you know, liberals actually read because people find him quite thoughtful and complicated. But he talks a lot, as do many in the party, Republican Party, of an ownership society. Okay, they want to make the U.S. an ownership society. Now, that, you can see that in a negative way. You can see it as, okay, this is just sort of, you know, grasping capitalism, and what about, you know, the poor, and what about, you know, the equalizing wealth and caring for the needy and so forth. And that's just not part of this narrative. It's been kind of co-opted out. In the ownership society, each of us is a self-reliant entrepreneur. And, well, that sounds kind of grasping and materialistic to me, and the Republican response is, no, it's not. It makes you a stakeholder. Okay? I mean, if you've owned land, or owned property, or owned a home, or owned anything, right, you care for it. You feel some sense of investment in whatever that is. So wouldn't it be great, the notion here is, if we all could be owners, stakeholders in society. And so what should government be doing? It should be clearing the path, okay, so that all people can be owners. And, you know, liberals like me, I was thinking, yeah, but, you know, come on, let's be realistic. Okay, let's be realistic. There's a lot of folks out there who don't have the wherewithal.
It's not a level playing field. Not everybody can be an entrepreneur and an owner in this kind of ownership society. At the same time, though, I think it sort of appeals to certain sorts of themes in American society, you know, the self-reliant, Horatio Alger kind of image, Ben Franklin, rags to riches, moving up, pulling your bootstraps up kind of notion that many of us find, yeah, I like that. That's pretty compelling. I like that kind of optimistic story about the American protagonist who moves forward. Okay, so that's one way, I think, in which certain Republican policies kind of have taken on this rhetoric that many people, liberals and conservatives, sort of like, and then claimed ownership of it, and it's hard for the liberals to get it back. A lot in the press these days, and it's become, there's almost an article every day about how the Christian right was very instrumental and has been very instrumental for years in pushing Republican agendas and likely responsible in part for Bush's victory. And Karl Rove has been sending messages, positive messages to the Christian right, and he's opened up dialogue with them for years. But there are many Christians out there who are not right, that is, on the right wing, okay? But I have a lot of friends in academia who aren't part of the Christian tradition, okay? And I tell them I'm a Lutheran, and when they think of Christians, okay, they're thinking of the conservative denominations for the most part. And if you look at things like, okay, church attendance is a very strong predictor of who voted for George W. Bush. There are many Christians on the other side of the continuum, but the ones who are sort of getting all the play right now tend to be the ones who, push things that have typically been associated more with the Republican right. So we talk about, I have a chapter in my book called God Bless America. And it's it's somewhat ironic, but it's also, in political discourse, very much out there. I mean, many young people at Northwestern University, young Republicans, believe and tell me that God is on their side, okay? And these are not zealous crazies. These are some of my best students, really nice kids, who are gonna go out and do good things in the world. But they believe that the Republican Party is the party of God. The Democrats have lost their way. They're unchurched, they don't have values. And I'm thinking, they do have values. I mean, it's a different set, maybe. And so, there's all that. There's no way to discount also the war on terror here, and how that influenced, in a different vein, the war in Iraq, the current situation that we live in. There's actually research to show this, real empirical studies, that when people feel threatened, okay, when they feel that they're going through a period of either personal threat or national threat, what kinds of leaders do they want? They want strong, simple leaders, typically more conservative, okay, who will get us through this tough time, all right? It clearly worked to George W. Bush's advantage that we were at war during the last election. It may not work to the advantage of the candidate in 08 for the Republican Party if this war continues to go badly, but at that time, at least, that kind of fear and sense of uncertainty seemed to work in the favor of the innocent hero, reinforcing this idea that we are the innocent hero in a dangerous world. Whenever you set up the world to be dangerous, okay, I think it plays into the redemptive self and works in favor of the strong leader. Yes?
What do you have to say about during both World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War, that we had for a large part of the Korean War, we had a Democrat
war? It was Democrat wars I learned about when I was growing up. The Democrats start wars and so forth. Yeah, it's a kind of different political landscape back then, I think. Each situation is sort of different. But I do think that, the general finding is that leaders who come across as being strong and focused will typically do better, at least during a period of uncertainty and so on like that. But yeah, it's a really good question.
FDR was sort of the great liberal of our time.
Well, the Iraq War is very much the kind of war that Republicans for years have been accusing Democrats of getting us involved in. It's nation building, right? Bill Clinton was criticized strongly for joining UN forces in the Serbian conflicts, criticized by Republicans, the same ones who are now strongly supporting the Iraq War of Liberation. And it is great to see the Iraqi people voting. It's inspiring, okay? Probably everybody in the room believes in democracy, right? We want Iraq to be a democracy, I suspect. Nobody here, I suspect, is a fan of Saddam Hussein. It's, you know, when he's on, you know, you don't want him on your side, right? You don't want to root for that. You don't want to root for the terrorists and so forth. You don't want, and so all of that has sort of come to work in favor of this administration. Now, it could be over time, you know, we'll really just get tired of it. And as casualties mount, I mean, and then things could turn around, as they did. You know. No, the Iraqi casualties are like out of sight.
And then the people are killed there.
It's a great untold story, I think. Yeah, yeah. And finally, redemption, okay. What kind of redemption do Republicans sell? Often a religiously toned redemption, okay? Salvation, atonement. George W. Bush, when asked who's his favorite philosopher in the 2000 debates, picked political philosopher, picked Jesus Christ. Okay, all the academics I know thought, ah, ha, ha, boy, is he a moron. He should have picked Rousseau or something. He played great. It was one of the smartest things he ever did, right? I mean, that worked, okay? Appeal to those religious images. Some Democrats can do it too. Clinton was able to kind of talk the talk when it comes to religion, especially, you know, like in the African-American church and so forth. He's really good at that, but, you know, a lot of Democrats can't do it. The imagery of redemption via upward mobility and liberation. Okay, these don't necessarily have to go to the Republican side, but they seem to be kinds of ideas that the Republicans have kind of taken ownership of, and it leaves others wondering about how might liberals find redemptive rhetoric, take back some of this redemptive rhetoric. I mean, what do we do with this situation?
I think to me the really key aspect of your redemption story here is the upward mobility when you talk about Democrats and Republicans, because there's oftentimes the real question in the Democrats' minds is, what about the poor? You know, when we're talking about, you know, the Republican thing, that's fine for everybody who has money, but what about the rest? And so in the Republican story, the poor are the ones who need to be redeemed. And they're not redeemed through government programs or handouts or stuff like that. They're redeemed when, in the Republican redemption story, they, you know, get off their lazy, you know, bottom end ass. Yeah, I didn't want to say that, but
I got that from Joe.
Get off their lazy ass, get a job, they'll learn, you know, what do that they know already is right.
Take responsibility.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's the redemptive story of the Republicans in regards to the poor. And it's, you know, and the government, like you said at the beginning, Aaron, the first thing, the government needs to get out of the way and allow the redemption to happen.
Yeah. Encourage them. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I'm currently reading God's Politics by
yes.
Jim Wallace.
Yes.
And in fact, our church is bringing out some discussions about it. I've only read about 100 pages. But one thing.
Do all you know this book, the Jim Wallace, God's Politics?
It's a great book. Of course I do.
Yeah.
But in there he said, they feel that God is on their side. He says, you want to be on the side of God, not on whose side is God. He also says that George Bush won so well because he wasn't afraid to talk about his Christianity. And we've always kind of been, you know, Muslim status, but he wasn't afraid to do that. And Kerry came to part of the world in that respect. And his moral values, he's always talking moral values. The poor are mentioned in the New Testament by the name of the Lord.
The particular brand of Christianity that seems to come from the right is really exclusionary. I mean, I grew up as a Lutheran and stopped accepting believe this kind of Christianity is one of us, otherwise you're not. And that's a very clear message, I think, this administration sends, both through their expression of belief and their politics. And he says much, either for us or against us.
I wonder, if for political discourse, you always need to have some sort of other. And I'm thinking about in the heyday of Democrat power, FDR, and so forth, we were the workers.
and the other were the sort of greedy capitalist owners. And now Republicans will say, well, that's class warfare. You don't want to do that. And it seems that that kind of us versus them sort of worked for a while. Now, maybe that's not the kind of, maybe we can never do that kind of rhetoric, but maybe that's not the right way to take
it. But it seems like in a religious forum, that's different than class warfare or capitalist versus workers. It's about acceptance and tolerance and sharing beliefs. And that's what really, I think, is kind of onerous about what they've done with it.
Well, isn't it a culture warfare now? I mean, it's
this kind of culture war going on here.
Yeah. I mean, and they're promoting this whole system of values and bringing faith-based stuff into government work and just the whole nine yards with that.
Anti-science kind of thing goes on. There is. And so then, so how do you couch that? I mean, do you, if you're sort of a strategist in this, and most of us are not, but do you accentuate the class war, or the culture war, and say, okay, we really represent something on the left that is just, it's better in some way than what you folks are doing, or do you look for common ground? You know, I mean, I was having an argument last night over in the Chalet, with somebody, and we were saying, well, should the Democrats go for a flaming liberal who really stands for something to rally the base the way George W. rallies the base of the Republicans, or should they find a more accommodating figure who's like in the middle ground? And I was arguing, well, as the Republicans move more and more and more and more over to the right, the middle ground, you might be able to run pretty well. Because they're still way over there, but. It's an open question. Yeah, Mike.
How much of this is really, I don't know really in sociology that they gain credence to this or not, but sort of the pendulum effect. Where you look in the 1960s, where things were very liberal, government programs were sort of all the rage, they poured lots of money into great society, and then it was, I think it was Ronald Reagan, and I can't remember who Ronald Reagan's hero was, who basically stood up and believes that government is not, government is not the answer to problems,
problem. Yeah, well, there's clearly been the shift, and it's a pendulum kind of thing, and I guess, from the standpoint of the left, that people are trying to figure out a way to bring it back. I'm sorry, we are out of time. I lost track on that. Thank you all for coming, and enjoy your time.
Thank you.